Dr. Smith. Maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan. And we will discuss whether the US-led Five Eyes intelligence community has taken its compound eye off white supremacist activity on the internet. And in the second half of this episode, we will be joined by investigative journalist and barrister Ollie Nias to follow up on the New Zealand government and what it knew and didn't know at the point when a decision was made to green light Rocket Lab's March mission. And that's a mission that carries US military payload that is proving to be controversial. But before we kick off this week's program, here's an invitation to those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, feel free to make comments. And if you do, we'll be able to include your interaction in this program. Okay, so let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online to discuss this first issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Kia ora, Selwyn.
Paul, this controversy around what the security agencies have been doing and what they haven't been doing relating to monitoring white supremacist activity on the internet, particularly with the 4chan and the Chan sites in general, and particularly also in the dark web. That has been under discussion in the New Zealand media for the past week, and it's clearly a sensitive issue in this part of the world and globally too, particularly after the terrorist attacks that happened on the two mosques in Christchurch on March 15, almost 2 years ago. Paul, what is your summary and take on this whole situation right now?
Well, certainly in New Zealand, it's a tale of promises broken. Promises that were made by telecommunications companies to the effect that they would deplatform well-known extremist sites like 4chan and 8chan, pursuant to the Christchurch call, which came out 2 months after the March 15 attacks, and which commits governments and telecommunications companies to work together voluntarily to rid the internet of the scourge of extremism, no matter what sort of extremism, not just white supremacists, but jihadists, anything that advocates the murder and other acts of violence against others was essentially on the hit list. Well, neither the telecommunications companies nor the security authorities who also pledged to make extremism a priority of their focus and that they would in fact scour social media in order to locate extremists when they were online and then deal to them if they were deemed to be a threat, as was the case in this most recent incident, they too appear to have backed off on that promise, because what we've discovered is that this particular extremist operating on 4chan was not discovered by the security authorities of New Zealand or the other Five Eyes partners. It was discovered by a loose collection of volunteer activists who trace they're anti-fascist activists who follow extremists online. And when they saw this individual talking about car bombs to commemorate the March 15 attack in Christchurch against one of the mosques, then they alerted the authorities, and the authorities then subsequently made arrests. But they did not find this individual of themselves. And so the question there is, they were given a lot more resources after March 15th. They promised to make the search for extremists on social media a top priority. And yet they failed to locate this individual, and he wasn't hiding. He was out on the open on 4chan.
On the open internet, on 4chan and the open internet, not on the Onion network or the dark web, as many would refer to it as.
No, as I told you in our private conversation, just out of curiosity, because I had assumed that the telecommunications companies had deplatformed their, you know, these guys. And so a couple days ago, when all of this came up, I decided to go look for 4chan. It took me two clicks to get to 4chan using a search engine as the first thing. It took me three clicks to get to the really ugly stuff.
Yeah.
So there is no filtration. There's nothing. And if they say that they cannot do it, I have an answer to them. Very recently, Apple Applications announced that it was deplatforming the website called Parler, which is a gathering place for right-wing extremists in the United States. And they just made an announcement that Parler was gone from their apps. It's as easy as that if there is a will to do so. Apparently, the telcos in New Zealand don't have the will to do so, even in light of March 15th. And then who knows what the security authorities are doing, because quite frankly, I find it appalling that they couldn't have discovered this guy sitting out in the open as he was.
Now, that's fair comment. With respect to the ISPs, it's almost as if they are waiting for government to actually enforce this so that they don't breach any code of conduct that they believe in, the freedom of speech areas, the freedom of where their users may wish to go to exchange their presence on the internet. If that is the case, and it does appear that that is the case, New Zealand has a history already with legislation that bans the abilities of people in this country from accessing extreme pornography. Various sites are banned, etc. That sniffing technologies came in by way of legislation and regulation by the National Led government some years ago now. Judith Collins was very prominent, obviously, in that space of pushing that through. Now, with this, there is difficulties that particular law does not capture these versions of expressing hate, even when the planning of hate is taking part on prominent Chan network sites. And it seems that the emphasis is on the government to get this done reasonably quickly. I understand from reading material on this, the Minister of Internal Affairs has sent this particular legislation, this bill in the New Zealand Parliament, to the Select Committee for discussion. There is opposition on freedom of speech grounds that it shouldn't be banning access to such things. But Paul, on that kind of issue, I believe myself that it's in the public interest and obviously the national interest to have that legislation in place that takes the burden of choice off the telcos, and the government says, we're not having access to these miserable sites of hate. It's off the table now. This technology enforces that to take place. Then you get a shift of those who wish to express and access those going via the Tor network, perhaps into the dark web, and doing it on the dark web's versions of these sites as well. But some would see that as a problem and a challenge. I would put it to people that that actually narrows down the scope where the intelligence agencies can then place their resource. I'm very surprised when we're picking up this issue in the research that New Zealand is a part of the Five Eyes network, and that surveillance on such things led by the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. that none of those countries picked this up, red flagged this this activity on the 4chan site in this instance, and sent it to the New Zealand authorities to get action. It took activists to actually identify, and I think that's great. You know, the minister in overseeing the security agencies here says that that's a good thing, that people are watching and they're alerting, that tip-offs are how intelligence agencies often work. Yes, but there's also this mandate, this requirement, this expectation, and quite frankly, a lack of tolerance when this isn't occurring, as you have put out.
Yeah, I think that there's actually a natural progression at play here. Private profit-oriented companies are not going to voluntarily turn around and impose bans that might hurt their bottom line. I say might because a lot of these extremist channels have advertising and that sort of thing connected to them. But there clearly is no social conscience on the part of internet providers. There are no ethical constraints. They pay lip service to it. But more importantly, they want to be forced into the position of not having to do so by choice. That is to say, they want the government to legislate. And if the government legislates, they will adhere to the government's guidelines. So it puts the ball in the government's court. Well, authoritarian regimes have no problem whatsoever. I lived in Singapore. Singapore bans stuff all the time for whatever reasons the regime deems necessary. In liberal democracies, it's a little trickier. But what I would simply say is, okay, it's clear now we're going to need legislation that updates current prohibitions on various forms of hate and what have you. But let us be very clear, and I think I'm preaching to the converted here, what you're seeing on sites like 4chan and 8chan is not protective offensive speech, where people talk bad about other human beings for whatever rationale. On these sites, you are getting open incitement to murder, mass murder, torture, and other acts of extreme violence against people because of their religion or who they look like. This is not protected under any definition of offensive speech. These people
say that any reasonable person watching this or following this issue would say, all of that stuff relating to free speech in this instance is all a diversion. It doesn't actually come into consideration. Ban it, clean it up, and surveil those areas that remain accessible via the dark web.
Yeah, no, and that's where I'm going with this line of thought. We have to remember that intelligence agencies, and in this case it'll be signals intelligence agencies, they can intercept, they can interfere with malicious cyber activity. They do that as a matter of course with regards to hackers and that sort of thing. But they're not going to reveal their ability to interfere with the malicious activities of extremists because their stock and trade is secrecy, including the secrecy of the technologies that they use. More importantly, if they're going to target New Zealand citizens, they're going to need a warrant to eventually do so if they're going to go in and seize computers and that sort of thing. So they may well be looking at the dark web as I know they're looking at the dark web, but again, Reddit, 4chan is out in the open.
Yeah.
There's no reason to be spooky about it. You know, that's the thing, is that they could have, and here's a problem, Selwyn. The police last December announced that they created a dedicated unit to monitor social media using artificial intelligence and algorithms that would pick up extremist terminology and that sort of thing. And yet here we are, 3 months later, and they were clueless when it came to this fellow on 4chan. So something's amiss. Something clearly is not going right. But you nailed something. Many people believe that if you force the baddest of the bad into the dark web, they'll be harder to find. I will tell you, coming out of an intelligence background, that no, actually, the intelligence agencies of many countries, including the Five Eyes, are already inside the dark web.
Absolutely.
Because the dark web attracts bad guys of all sorts, arms traders, drug traders, kiddie pornographers. I mean, you name it, the nastiness is there in full display. And so that's the natural habitat of many of the covert operations of signals intelligence agencies around the world. So if you force the bad people into the dark web, two things will happen. The people who are just talkers and want to rant, rave, and act tough on open forums, they'll go away. Mm. And the true bad apples, and I would say there's about 1 in 10 of those, they'll go to the dark web and they will eventually be located. It'll take a little longer, but they will be located. So I think putting legislation in place, since it voluntary compliance clearly is not working, and then going after the bad guys as they flee open forums and sites like the big social media platforms, might actually turn out to be a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Paul. That's well put. There are some events that are coming up to discuss exactly all of this type of stuff. The academics are certainly keeping a close eye on it. University of Otago put out a statement yesterday, Wednesday the 10th of March, and it is saying that it's holding an event which will discuss all of these things that we're talking about, Paul, all within the kind of space of the Christchurch call, what's being implemented, what isn't, and that's taking place down there. And I just suggest that our audience kind of follow things online with respect to this. When? 16th to the 17th of March, so it's only a matter of 5-6 days away from now, and the venue is there, it's all on site. Just do a search, Otago University Christchurch Call event, and it'll take people to that type of thing, and they can follow that issue. Of course, what this is doing, Paul, is also getting a lot of commentary relating to the New Zealand security community and its responses in this. But remember, we are a part of a broad, wide network. Wouldn't you expect, and this is dovetailing to where we started on this issue, wouldn't you expect that it would be picked up by at least the United States, if not them, the Brits, if not them, Canada, certainly Australia, considering the nature of what went down 2 years ago in Christchurch, or New Zealand? And it seems like there is not a coordinated kind of approach to this. We're on the outside of this community, of course, so we're flying blind as to what goes on within. But you would imagine that if something was red flagging from within the security community, that would have transferred across to the New Zealand police and the SIS to actually get in there, sniff this guy out, and do something about it.
Well, first of all, even though we're part of Five Eyes, each Five Eyes partner has its own priorities. And the priority state may overlap and dovetail when it comes to great power competition, and common enemies. But let's be very clear, in spite of the claims that focusing on extremism is a priority, it is clearly not. And if you think about it this way, from again, the intelligence network's point of view, is right-wing extremism outside of the United States, Germany, and the UK an existential threat to the social fabric? No, it's not. Are the chances of another white extremist strike on New Zealand high or low? More than likely low, especially given the supposed scrutiny.
They're still at a moderate alert, aren't they?
Oh, they fiddle with levels as they please. Yep. Okay, it may have no relation to the reality of the situation. They're still looking for jihadists. And I would argue that the threat of jihadists is lower than that of white extremists. But my point is this: for all the talk about focusing on ideological extremism, it seems to me very clear that that is simply not a priority for the intelligence agencies aligned in the Five Eyes network. And then where you do see incidents like this, where someone pops up who is focused on New Zealand, the Australians, the Canadians, the Americans, and the UK either are not looking at the location of the individual or think that it's New Zealand's responsibility to deal with it, and they worry about their own citizens. I mean, the United States has its handful with white supremacists right now. So
absolutely,
you can see that they're not focusing on some guy talking tough about New Zealand. So I think this is another betrayed promise. They say that the fight against extremism is a foremost priority of the intelligence community, and yet they fail to deliver on very simple things like finding someone on an open forum.
Yeah. Paul, okay, we'll go on to our next issue, which is respect to Rocket Lab. And we'll pull in Ollie Nies, who's waiting online to get in and discuss this issue. So I'll just do a transition. We'll pull him in. We'll be right back. Good afternoon, Ollie.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to A View from Afar, and thank you for joining us to discuss Rocket Lab's latest mission and exactly what is going on. Now, you've done a lot of work in this space, and I applaud you for that. Investigative journalism is a rare beast, and it's great to see some excellent examples of investigative journalism happening in this space. Without the work of people like yourself, the general public would not be aware of what is basically happening and being launched from New Zealand soil. So, Ollie, what, you know, we're getting down to the approval process. So Rocket Lab would plan, as I understand it, plan for a mission, a launch at a particular time. There is a requirement where it discloses its intent to the New Zealand government. It goes to the minister. In this case, it's Stuart Nash. He looks at the planned mission and he either, under a set of criteria, either gives it the green light or he says no. Is that accurate? And what is happening with respect to this particular mission in March? And what did the New Zealand government know and what it didn't know?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I mean, if you were to take the statements of the minister himself on their face value, you might come away thinking that the government didn't know a whole lot. In Parliament, in response to questions recently, Stuart Nash said he was unaware of the specific military capabilities of the Gunsmoke J satellite, which is the one we're talking about. But of course, as you mentioned, the minister is just one part of a broader regulatory framework around space launches. So the way that works is broadly, as you said, but satellite operators, whether they're commercial or government agencies, apply directly to the space agency rather than through Rocket Lab. The space agency then assesses those applications against the legal criteria and then makes a recommendation to the minister. Now, in this case, one thing that's notable is Rocket Lab announced the mission publicly. They did that last month, saying they would launch it this month. But at that time, the minister said he had not received any application for the mission, let alone approved it. Then 1 week passed. Not only had he received an application, but he'd approved it. And then the week after that is when he said he wasn't aware of the military capabilities of the satellite.
So does this shift to the breakdown in the space agency area, which is a New Zealand government body, as I understand it, that correct? Is it a breakdown at that point where they're not conveying to the minister the pertinent information so that he can make an informed decision?
It's somewhat hard to tell. It may just be the case that Stuart Nash is just not paying much attention or quite simply has a bad memory. Typically, the way it works from a paperwork perspective is that the space agency will provide a briefing to the minister, which says, you know, look, here's the satellites, here's at a high level their capabilities, their purpose. We recommend that you approve it. There are no national interest concerns or legality concerns. So I would be speculating to say where that breakdown is at. And I think more likely what it suggests is that from the minister's perspective, it's something of a rubber stamping exercise. He's not asking, it doesn't seem, at least in this case, that there's independent questions being asked, which is unusual given that there was media attention around this before he approved it. And yet, you know, once he'd approved it, he said he wasn't across the details.
Yeah. So this particular mission in March, as you've reported, it raises a lot of eyebrows and a lot of concerns. Does it meet the expectation of the New Zealand public, the Pacific Island state independence that New Zealand likes to present itself? This payload, for example, is carrying stuff that is of concern to many, including Paul Buchanan, who's with us here, obviously, for this discussion. So what exactly is this payload and what raises the concerns of people that follow this very closely like yourself, Ollie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this payload is really interesting. on one level because it's the most overt contribution to US military capabilities from a satellite launched from New Zealand so far, but also because the nature of it, I think, raises a lot of these questions about where the boundaries are with our space industry. So in a narrow sense, what this payload is doing is it's a small transfer capabilities. It's an experimental satellite in that area. But that's only part of it. You know, according to official documents from the US Defense Department that are available online, the purpose of this is to improve US targeting capabilities. And so that obviously raises a lot of questions because the, I think, common understanding of our space industry is that it's meant to be non-military in nature, although recognizing that when it comes to space activity, the boundaries between civil and scientific and military applications are very, very blurred. But this is a satellite which, as far as its purpose is concerned, seems to veer very much into the military technology, the warfighting technology specifically.
And so New Zealand would not know the United States' future intentions should it use this new technology, should it be planning a particular conflict that New Zealand may elect to stay well away from, that it doesn't fit our national interest, doesn't fit our own country's expectations of the global order of security, et cetera, et cetera. So does that bring New Zealand into a problematic space, pardon the word, when it comes to considering these things? And what takes priority here, good relations with the United States or New Zealand's own national identity?
Well, certainly increasing numbers of people seem to be concerned. Early this week, the Peace Foundation released its open letter to the Prime Minister raising concerns. That's been endorsed by a number of civic groups. But what that letter hones in on, and I think very, very effectively, is this challenge. You know, it's one thing to look at the technical capabilities of a satellite and say, in this case, it's testing how data is transmitted from small satellites to Earth. It's another to assess what the true purpose is, and particularly to assess how that's going to change over time. It requires not only technical information, but information about the future plans of the US military, which is obviously a very sensitive area. Now, the space agency says that it's very comfortable with the approval process. Under the Technology Safeguards Agreement, which is a treaty we entered with the US to allow for the transfer of rocket technology to New Zealand, the US government is required to provide sufficient information, is the term, to allow New Zealand to make an assessment of its compliance with our laws and policies. But of course, what does that mean? And I think unavoidably it comes down to trust. And that brings us to the diplomatic point I think you foreshadowed there, which is there's a tension here and what takes priority. Very clearly, the government has committed in a big way to the facilitation of the space industry for all kinds of reasons. And the reality is that the US government and the US military is a major client of Rocket Lab. And so in Rocket Lab, at this stage, 99% of New Zealand space industry. So there is a real, real tension there. The New Zealand government has tried to draw a line. It says certain things are off limits. But as we're seeing with this payload, there are some real questions as to exactly where that line is.
So within the status quo at the moment, do you think, being pragmatic, that New Zealand government is really able to ban such payloads? And if not, what has to happen to be able to make sure that good decisions, informed decisions are made that are in step with what the general public believes is the New Zealand way?
Well, from a strict legal perspective, the current legal regime does allow the minister to say no to a payload. The minister can decline an approval if he considers the payload to not be in the national interest, and that's a very broad term that gives him a lot of discretion. He could choose to say this payload is not in the national interest, but that's obviously only part of it because there is a broader diplomatic tension which we've discussed, which is what would be the consequences for the space agent, space industry generally and New Zealand's relationships with its security partners if it starts taking a more restrictive view on what can be launched from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the question of, is the regime good enough? What's required to give the public confidence? I think fundamentally it's greater transparency. So the cabinet from 2019 meant, but those essentially are extremely vague when it comes to military technology. And I think the public would benefit from greater clarity as to specifically where the red line is.
Ollie, thanks for joining us on the program. That's absolutely fantastic from the point of view of providing us an informed position on exactly where we are. And we'll continue this conversation on. But thanks for joining us, and I look forward to perhaps your participation again in the future.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks, Ollie. Bye-bye. So, Paul, you heard all of that. What are your take-out points from what Ollie's reportage and his findings and what he was saying there are?
I'm very glad that he came on the program because he illuminated a lot of things. I think the bottom line is this, Selwyn. There's three aspects to it. The first one is that there are a lot of actors in New Zealand who are invested in New Zealand's space program, military and otherwise. That includes the New Zealand Defense Forces, which have now created their own space agency, the intelligence services, who may avail themselves of nanosatellite launches from the Mahia Peninsula, and of course the diplomatic alignment that New Zealand seeks with the United States as it looks forward to the future, including future conflicts, because our cooperation now may pay some security dividend in the future, at least in the minds of our diplomats and defense officials. So that's the first angle that mitigates in favor of the continuation of these launches. The second one is the legislation. You know, I used the word gobbledygook last week. Let's just say that it's too loose. It talks about prohibiting nukes in space. Well, they don't need nukes in space. That's reflective of a bygone era when nuclear weapons were considered the panacea for anyone trying to get the high ground. They have dumb satellites that can run into other satellites if they want to kill them off. And these low altitude orbit things are, let's just say, a target rich environment for interstellar satellites. So the legislation reflects a mindset. Again, environmental damage and that sort of thing that, you know, again, I use the term gobbledygook, not because I want to be mean to the people who framed that legislation, but because I think it actually is meaningless when it comes to concretely putting restrictions on what can be on those nose cones.
And so, that's okay.
Let me just finish with the third element.
Yeah.
Third element is, it's like the old Reagan comment, trust but verify. We're relying on the Americans telling us what are in the nose cones. We have no means of verifying that. It's not as if the New Zealand authorities climb up on the top of the booster and take a look at the satellite actually being launched.
And a phrase comes to mind of neither confirm nor deny when things are sensitive, yeah.
And, well, I mean, when you have the minister responsible for New Zealand's role in space, say a week after the Rocket Lab announces the launch and the minister says he has no idea what's going up on that booster, we got serious problems. I mean, you know, either he is incompetent or he's not getting full information in a timely way just for PR reasons. And I guess the bottom line is this, and Ollie did allude to it, and we are now getting some debate. As you and I have talked about before, there's been all too little public and parliamentary debate about what New Zealand's role in space is, particularly military applications in space, going forward. And this brings up the issue that we've talked about in the past, which is where on the kill chain do we want to locate ourselves? It's one thing to put up a geospatial mapping satellite where you map out the terrain where hostilities may occur. It may be another thing to put up nanosatellites that are good signals intercepts of hostile actors waging war against our allies. But we are about to put up a real-time tactical targeting constellation of satellites that will be used to kill people in real time. The U.S. Army is very proud of that. We have obfuscated. Why? Because we have a different set of ethical, moral, and diplomatic values when it comes to the militarization of space. And therein lies the rub. Without a good debate, as Ollie spoke about, we can't get to where we draw that line. My line may be higher towards the trigger pull than your line, but it's worth debating what or both of us can live with. What are we comfortable with? And none of that has occurred, with the exception of Ollie's reporting and that of a very few, a small handful of others who are now calling our attention to, quite frankly, is obvious on the other side of the Pacific, because it was the U.S. Army's press releases that first alerted us to the fact of this launch, so or what the payload was. So I think that if we move in the direction, we just got to define. We just got to define where do we feel comfortable in the kill chain. So we've got, is it down at the bottom?
Yeah, whereabouts on that on that line, and that's that's a fair point, and that can be applied in many different areas of foreign policy and defence policy as well. I would assert. Now, there's a comment that has come in from Kevin Hester. Rocket Lab have put a target on Aotearoa New Zealand by working for a foreign government hell bent on war with China and Russia. Remember, these are comments that are coming in. We should remove ourselves from the Five Eyes network and become a neutral, non-aligned nation. It worked for Ireland and Switzerland in the last war. So the suggestion there from Kevin is that New Zealand should place itself firmly on the independent part of this interaction. There are many that would share that concerns, but what this also raises is this issue we touched on in brief last week, Paul, that does such activity place New Zealand at risk should conflict escalate between the global powers of which, let's face it, include our biggest trading partners?
And I, you know, Kevin's concerns are very well placed. I would say, simply say this, I've said it before, it's worth repeating. If we continue to launch U.S. military satellites into space, we do, in fact, become a target. The launch site becomes a target for hostile actors when it comes to the United States. I have no doubts that military planners in some countries have prepared plans for sea-launched ballistic missiles to be launched against the Mahia Peninsula in the event of major conflict, because that takes out the capability to replace satellites destroyed in space with newer satellites of the same sort. No military planner worth his salt is going to pass on the opportunity so long as they keep up. Now, here's the rub. The Rocket Lab business model, and again, Rocket Lab just provides the booster, not the nose cone, is premised on military sales. You see, they want to be able to launch rockets commercially for less than $5 million a launch. Yeah. In order to do that, the only people who have the deep pockets to fund the experimentation with these boosters is big military apparatuses, even if they're attached to universities and what have you, and they cover some of their tracks. So it's like a Faustian bargain, you know, a bargain with the devil. You're using the U.S. military to improve the commercial viability of the boosters down the road. But in doing so, you're now beholden to that military partner. And if that military partner has no real checks on what it can put inside the nose cones, then you're relying on that military partner to tell you the truth every which time. And I think that that's a step too far. So, but here's the solution to Kevin's conundrum. If we get out of the military launch business, there's no reason for anyone to target us. In fact, at that point, the targeting will become economic espionage in order to get, you know, the technologies involved in the launch. But so long as we're putting up stuff that the U.S. military uses and now uses in combat situations, you can be assured that there's something at sea that has a bullseye painted on the Mahia Peninsula.
That's a grave warning. And on that point, Paul, that just demonstrates why the politicians have got to actually tidy up this particular area and with a degree of urgency, I would suggest. Thank you for your contribution. Thanks to Ollie Nias for contributing on this issue earlier into the program. We look forward to your company again, this time next week. Until that time, stay safe and take care.